Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dip.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach on this March 9th, 2019, which sounds like a science fiction book to me. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, presuming it's March 9th where you are, unless you are on the west side of the international dateline, in which case it can be March 10th and you can still call us. Maybe, I don't think we've ever gotten a call from the other side of the international dateline. In which case, what you dial 1+.
Unless it's in American Samoa.
You can just dial regularly out of
American
Samoa.
I don't know. I've never been there. But is that international?
It's Tomorrowland.
If it's part of the United States.
I think it's still an international call. I don't know.
I don't know. See, that's
could be a local call.
I don't know. Does local even mean anything anymore when you have a cell phone?
Try calling overseas and you'll realize local means the United States.
Yeah.
Actually,
it's
I don't know.
It's very local.
Now that I think about it, I routinely send text messages to Europe.
But the phone is from the United States.
No. It's got a European, it's got a Denmark telephone number on it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Jake's sister lives in Denmark,
yeah,
by the way.
And Jeff's daughter lives in Denmark.
They live at the same address. Yeah. We're trying to work this out.
It's a weird coincidence.
Hey, there's something. Again, the telephone number in here, 254-773-1400, if you want to interject some. But there's something really I find kind of a little bit refreshing in the news. It was in The Economist, and I looked at it, and it's very, very well researched, and in fact, it happened. It's actually from the Shanghai Bureau of The Economist. There was a very thorough Chang Zi-hsi at the University of Chicago and three co-authors from the Chinese University of Hong Kong made an interesting discovery. They found that not intentionally, but actually, the Chinese GDP is probably well overstated. And the reason it's overstated is not because the Chinese government overstates it. It's overstated because of the way they gather the information from the Communist Party chiefs who and then they take all that information and they cut it down because they realize all these guys were inflating what their various provinces were doing. And they try to get pretty close, but the real Chinese GDP in 2016 was around 4%. 4% growth. Now you think if you're like me, you think back a few years when the Chinese GDP was routinely reported as double-digit numbers, and then 8%, and then 7%, and then 6 points. As a matter of fact, it was reported in 2016 as 6-point-something%. In fact, it was around 4%, and there's no question it has declined since then. And here's the key to what I'm trying to say. There's a great deal of fear in the United States among many people I know that the Chinese economy, second largest in the world, is going to overtake us and we're going to be number two.
And it could happen.
We're
not going to discount that. But what we are saying
is that they are far enough behind us that if their economy, this last calendar year, our economy GDP legitimately grew somewhere between 2.9 and 3.1%. Theirs probably grew almost exactly the same amount during the same period, which means they ain't ever going to catch up with us.
If they grow the same percentage and they have a smaller economy, it means that we're pulling ahead of them. And that's something interesting to think about. This is something we talked about on the air. At the end of last year, I brought something up here. There's a demographic problem in China. The demographic problem is that they're not having enough babies. And they haven't had enough babies for a very long time. The average age of your average Chinese citizen is now older than the average age of the average American citizen. That means they are older than us. They just passed us up. There's a pretty steep decline or upward movement in their average age coming in the next 5 years. It's not going at the 1 year at a time. Unfortunately or fortunately, that's not how demographics work. We're having babies, And we're having enough babies to just about replace our population every year. We're right on that point. They're having half or less babies to replace each year's deaths, which means that their demographics get older faster than 1 year at a time. That's really weird to think of a country aging faster than 1 year for every year that it's aging.
So anytime that you hear the Chinese GDP reported and these soaring numbers, very consistently you can take 16% off of it. In other words, the Chinese GDP is about 84% of what was reported consistently over the years since 2007. Now, before 2007, they don't have data, but they're able to. There's enough that they things they can track in China, because they have a value-added tax, and they know what the value-added tax is, and there's a whole lot of series of other things they can track. So they've concluded that there's about a 16% inflation in the GDP of China. So just take 84% of whatever China says, and that's what their real GDP is. So if they come out with like a 4% GDP for last year, we did 3, they're really approximately equivalent. So
that's not catching up unless they maintain a higher percentage every year forever, at enough higher percentage. We haven't talked about this in a long time. This concept of how big is the economy of China. Well, number one, let's say there's a lot of people over there. They have more than 100 cities with population greater than 10 million. Hold on to that thought for a second.
Yep, there's a lot of Chinese.
There are a lot of people over there. They're getting educated at a very high rate. Mm-hmm. There's their university's quality is improving. They're still having way too few babies.
And it really boils down to the fact that they have some major obstacles to get around, and they're running out of steam to do it. And I think their prime minister probably knows that very, very well and is striving to do what he can to catch up before the demographic freight train slams into them. That's a very poor metaphor, but still, it's a reality that they probably will never pass the GDP of the United States of America. We're only saying probably and a lot of other things. So
now,
the reason I say that, let me say why I'm saying that. We don't have to be afraid of the Chinese. If they don't have the potential to pass us and they don't have the potential to create the wealth that we've created, then they don't have the potential to create a Navy the size of our Navy. And while they may get ahead in some small areas of technology, they don't generally tend to stay ahead very long.
This is similar to we talk about new experiments taking place in the world today. There's a grand new experiment taking place in Japan right now.
Oh, yeah.
The GDP of Japan is shrinking and has been fairly consistently shrinking for decades. But, important piece here, the per capita GDP, if you're breaking it down to each member of the population, has been increasing. Their population is dwindling. They're getting older. They're having fewer kids. Each child inherits a great deal of wealth. There's less people, so there's less wealth all around, but each person has more. So this is, as far as I can tell, and I've looked back, the last time this sort of thing happened was in large plagues, where the population dwindled, and that caused the wealth to dwindle faster than the death rate. So each person's per capita GDP did not go up. They didn't wind up at the end of the plague with more stuff, because the blacksmith died and you can't make metal stuff anymore.
Yep, yep.
And that sort of thing.
And they didn't have portable wealth, which we have today.
Right. So in Japan, they have portable wealth that transfers relatively easily. I realize anybody that's ever been through probate, Texas has great probate law, but it's still a pain. It's still a pain to transfer the wealth. You got to retitle things. You've got to transfer things. You've got to get things inspected and appraised. And there's a lot of stuff that has to happen. But it transfers relatively easily compared to history. So what we're seeing in Japan is, and I've been looking for this. I have been digging back all the way to ancient Greece, trying to find another time when a country's wealth diminished while the individuals and the population's wealth increased. And I find that absolutely fascinating. It's weird. They're having less of a role on the world stage, but more comfort at home. So maybe it happened to the Viking Scandinavia. It was really hard to measure wealth at the time. Yeah. When the Viking exodus happened, a lot of wealth came back to the Northern Europe area while the population dropped, but they didn't keep very good records of of their accounting.
That, and there's a lot of other complexities. But, you know, Japan could be a model going forward. We've always thought
should be a model for China in the demographics.
Well, and that's a point. That's a very important point if they're smart enough to do it. Those of you who've been around a few years, like I have, can remember when there was a great deal of fear that China was going to take over everything. Those of you who remember Back to
Japan,
the Future.
China was
going to take over everything.
Japan was going to take over.
Back to the Future was a legitimate worry at the time.
Yeah, Michael J. Fox, in his future version of himself, was learning Japanese and learning to bow to his boss.
Yes.
That was a real threat. I remember that.
Yeah, and they bought Pebble Beach and they bought Madison Square Garden. And by the way,
Rockefeller Plaza and they wound up
selling those properties for considerably less than they paid for them.
Back to Americans, yeah.
And this is one of those issues.
The Chinese are doing that at the moment, by the way. They had a big buying spree over the last 6 or 7 years, and it's going the other direction now at prices below what they purchased it for across New York and other high-value real estate properties.
I mean, we may very well have seen the Chinese influence at or near its peak in the world. China is portraying itself as a viable threat, and they're trying to lay claim to whatever they can lay claim to while they can do it.
And Russia still claims to be a viable threat. They are, but they are far below their peak in the Soviet Union era. It's similar to that.
Yeah, Russia's kind of an interesting thing. Their principal claim to fame in the world is they have nuclear weapons.
And a lot of oil and gas.
And a rapidly shrinking economy. Unlike the Japanese may have a shrinking economy, but it's shrinking because of low birth rate. The Russian economy is shrinking because anybody who can get out of the country is getting out.
Yeah.
And they have a low birth rate.
And a very, very high mortality rate. Yeah, their mortality, their life expectancy is pretty low there, and it's attributable to one thing, very, very easily attributable to one thing, and that's too much vodka drinking. That sounds like a joke, a bad joke, but it's just the reality. We have our mortality rate has gone up lately too, and ours is not vodka.
It's
opioids.
Well, opioids and cell phones.
Opioids and cell phones. Yeah, you're on the road
drinking cell phones.
Drinking cell phones while addicted to opioids.
Right.
Those are bad things. Don't do them. Don't use your cell phone on the road. Don't drink and drive. And even if a doctor prescribes you opioids, be really, really, really careful.
But it's an interesting factor in our decreasing birth rate. If you do it by economic quintiles, you like that?
Yeah.
Fifth.
Because that's how everybody is doing it when
right,
they do their birth rate.
Right. 20, 40, 60. The higher you get, in other words, if you're in the upper 20%.
As far as
economically,
income? Okay.
Income as far in the United States, or for that matter, in the upper 40%, your life expectancy
is getting longer.
Statistically, yours individually may not, but that group of people is getting a much longer life expectancy.
And that's,
the more money they have, the longer their life expectancy
gets. This is a very important factor. That isn't because of quality of medical care.
It's because absence of smoking, absence of opioids, and
right.
being smart enough not to walk across the street while trying to read texts
yeah.
on a cell phone.
Correct. So that to me says that in another generation, the entire population will be safer that tends to happen is that the wealthy people tend to pick up safety habits first and then mandate them like seatbelts.
That ties into what you were saying about what happens in Japan, where their mortality is low and
right.
they live a long time. As the broad income base goes up, and it is going up. And the good news is the lower 40% of the income in the United States is where we've seen during this recovery is where we've seen the largest percentile growth in income. That's not to say that the upper 1% is not making a lot of money. But when you look at the percentage growth by quintile, the bottom is the one that's doing the best right now as far as percentage growth and income.
Right.
So we're moving towards a position in the United States that is similar to that we see in Japan, where eventually, if we just keep on keeping on, we won't have very many or any poor people.
Well, if you think about the standards of today versus the standards of 30 years ago, we don't have any poor people today.
Well, we got homeless people on the streets.
Yes, but they're not going hungry.
They're voluntarily there.
Yeah, and that sounds harsh, but the reality is that
in the 1930s, people were starving to death.
Yes, and we're not doing that anymore. So by the standards of history and even by the standards of the rest of the world, there are no poor people left. I've got to update some numbers going forward after 2015, but I've got a long-term research on the growth of different groups of income, and I broke it down to I think I've got 15 different income groups. And the lowest income is increasing in income fastest.
Right.
And that's across the board, and it's against this massive statement that many on the left say that there's an income inequality. There is an income inequality, don't get me wrong, but it's not growing, it's shrinking. And that's a massive statement there. The other thing is a big statement by the left. It seems like most people that talk about income inequality or the concentration of wealth are very much on the left. Another thing they say is the one percenters have so much of the wealth of the United States. What they're missing is that the people in the 1% are generally not in the 1% of income for more than 2 years in their life. That group of people changes every year. Massively changes every year. There's just a teeny tiny fraction of that 1% that's there every year.
Let me throw something else in here that'll make the people somewhat to the right of center probably fairly happy.
We're making the right happy right now by trashing the left. So we might have to get equal opportunity in a minute.
Europe is teetering on the edge of slipping back into recession. And the as a result, the European Central Bank, ECB, announced that they have stopped raising interest rates, period, paragraph, we're not going to raise them anymore, and they have made emergency loans available to a lot of folks. And there's a couple of reasons to the banks in the various countries. These emergency low-interest loans are to allow the banks to loan out more money to people so they can get things started again, because business investment in the European Union, not in the European Union, in the Eurozone, the people who use the euro, has finally come back up to its peak that it hit in early 2008. We passed that 6 years ago in the United States. In other words, 6 years ago in the United States, our business investment passed where we were in 2008. The Europeans are finally just now getting there, and there's a couple of reasons that that's going on, and it relates to what you were saying a minute ago.
And the Shanghai Index has nowhere near gotten close to the peak that it had in 2007. Nowhere near. It's like a quarter of the value.
So we're talking about the fact that the European system, which heavily taxes wealth, has stifled something that keeps them from investing. And the second issue is something we did very virtuously here in the United States. We recognized right after the collapse that there were a bunch of bad loans out there and a bunch of bad banks, and we started shutting them down and using TARP and the Federal Reserve and whatever system we could to eliminate that debt from the system. We shut the banks down, moved them into other banks. We aggressively recognized the bad loans and the bad companies and got rid of them. The Europeans are still, the Europeans, and for that matter, the Japanese, are, and to a larger extent, even the Chinese, are still carrying zombie loans on the books of their banks. Now, zombie loans are loans that they don't want to recognize. They don't want to go in and foreclose on the company because it would cause unemployment. It would cause social disrest. But they have these very substantial loans outstanding that nobody is making interest payments on and nobody's making payments on, and they refuse to go in and foreclose and shut down companies or banks because it would cause unrest and would they'd have to admit that somebody messed up. Matter of fact, they're carrying a couple of whole countries on the books over there, Greece and Italy right now, with unpaid debts. And so there's a lot of pluses. And as we peek out in this economic cycle, and it does look more and more like we are reaching the crest of the wave here, and we may have some a lot of bad economic news coming down the road. It's always a possibility at this point. It's important to remember that our bad news is better. Our bad news is better than the good news in the rest of the world.
Yeah, and that's a really important factor. We wanted to talk a little bit about that, because we're talking in the past few weeks, in the past several, well, in the past year, we've talked about that we're due for a recession coming in the next several years sometime. Why is that? Well, because we're humans and we are not stopping doing things that humans have done throughout history. Recessions are not over forever. That doesn't ever happen. We're going to forever have recessions. And we've been 10 years now. Since the bottom of the market.
It's exactly 10 years.
Yeah, this week is 10 years from the bottom of the market, and that doesn't mean the end of the recession. But the recession didn't come that much longer.
Actually, July, the official end of the recession was July.
All right, so we're now right at the 10-year point without a recession since then. Mm-hmm. And before the Great Recession, and I often mock the nickname for that recession because I didn't think it was that great. I didn't like it at all, but somebody out there thought it was great. So the end that Great Recession really was a big one. It was huge. And we tend, as Americans and as any human, tends to measure future problems based on the most recent past one. So there's a lot more fear of recessions today than there was before the Great Recession. We were averaging a recession about every 4 years for 3 or 4 decades.
I think we should call it the terrible recession.
Yeah, we should call it the terrible recession, not the great one. It's a bad thing to say.
And it's important to recognize that because there's so much fear, and very frankly, the statistics are there, companies and individuals have more cash reserve now than we had any time at this point in an economic cycle in history. The Federal Reserve, for whatever it's worth, possibly they'd rather get rid of some of it, but they have a reserve on the books that's larger than they're comfortable with.
Yeah.
All that indicates that if we do get into a recession in 2020, it's going to be a mild one.
And there's extra pieces to that to show how mild it will be. One of the major pains of any recession is people losing jobs. People will lose jobs in the next recession. But we have been pulling people who were comfortably no longer working, retirees, back into the workforce with promises of large amounts of money. And they've been coming back reluctantly, but eventually coming back into the workforce. They're working now. I'm sure you know people that are like that.
Yeah.
I know people that are like that. The listeners probably know people that are like that. When we're looking at the labor participation rate, it hasn't changed over the last decade. It's right around 60.9%. Well, what does that mean? It means that more people have pushed themselves into the workforce. If 60% of the people, roughly, and it's kind of jiggled around a little bit, but it stayed right about 60%. And our unemployment rate has gone so far down, and we're still at 60% labor participation. What does that mean? That's the percentage of people who are adult age and say that they want a job or could have a job, that are capable of having a job, that haven't removed themselves by saying, I no longer want a job because I'm retired. That means that we've been pulling retirees back into the workforce. And as we just said it, we know it What are you pointing at? Go ahead.
63.2.
Okay, so it's give or take 5% for the last decade. It's been hovering right there. So we've come up a couple of percentage points. But when you look at how many jobs we've added in, we should have come up 10 or 15 percentage points.
Yeah, you were talking about the employment population ratio.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Employment population ratio.
That's 60.7.
Not the workforce.
See, we got to be geeky here, okay?
Yeah. So this concept is that next recession, when people are laid off, who are they? Who, if you're the boss, put yourself in the boss position.
All right, I will.
Okay.
You're fired.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate
it. Let me take that back. You're hired.
Turning my microphone off over here. I'm going to go home.
No. Actually, I've hired you about 1,000 times. I'd have to fire you about 1,000 times.
Okay. So you're the boss, and you've just hired a older person to come work
like
for
old Baldy.
And they are exceptionally good at what they do. They're really quality people. They were comfortably retired. These are the type of people that you can sit down and have this kind of conversation with. I've got to, you know, we've got to tighten up. I don't know what I'm going to do. You've been through this a few times. And they say, well, don't lay off any of these newbies. They've got their whole lives ahead of them. I'll just go back to retirement and call me if you need anything while I'm out. That is much more the layoffs that we expect at the next recession, a kind of sort of voluntary, all right, I'm ready to go anyway. Don't lay off the people that really need the jobs.
The other thing, from the perspective of most of our listeners, because this part of Texas tends to be tremendously resilient in a recession.
Yeah, we're resilient. We tend not to have the peaks that the rest of the country have, but we certainly don't have the valleys.
I'll tell you that what we saw was a rehearsal for it in December.
Yeah.
We saw a rehearsal for the bear market, and we almost got a bear. We came close enough to get to a bear market, a cat's whisker difference. It will probably be V-shaped. In other words, there will be a massive panic at some point, I suspect, if we follow history. Because when we get indications of a recession, traders will still remember 2008 and 2009, a few of them will anyway, and they will panic and run for the doors. The issue is, though, we don't have the excesses built up. We don't have the bubbles. Yeah, we've got some corporate debt issues out there. And
that's a real thing.
That is probably, it's very likely to be the trigger. We're probably going to find out, as Philip Corray, I believe, originally said. I'm not completely sure on this, but I know he said it. You never know who's not wearing swimming trunks until the tide goes out. But this next bear market and recession that's coming up will be relatively mild, relatively short, and be very, very, very good for us. You're going to see some companies fail, the ones who are doing high-yield debt right now, high-yield bonds. Because they are paying high interest rates and they're staggering along and they had to borrow money at high interest rates because they don't have good cash flow. And if they are at that point in the height of the economy, they may be in a little bit of trouble going forward. And I think we may need to do some commercials.
Let's do it. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400 if you'd like to give us a call. If you don't want to give us a call, that's okay too. There's a couple of things worth noting at this point, and I don't know why it's occurring at this particular moment, but because I do what I do and Jake does what he does, we are getting barraged with annuity advertisements. And I'm looking at one right now in a national publication that says 9.6% annuity return. Annuities are not regulated the way securities are. If somebody promised a 9.6% return on a securities portfolio or strategy, the SEC would come down on them with a sledgehammer. But because they're not regulated at the federal level, they can make these amazingly absurd claims. There is nothing in the world, and this is something I'm going to emphasize to you. There is nobody and nothing in the world that can promise a 9.6% gain over time on any investment, no matter how good it is. But it's right here. It's in Barron's, right at the top of the page, from annuityalliance.com. There's another one I got just a few minutes ago that just popped up that was offering an 8-point-something% annuity. Don't fall for that. They are using some very confusing numbers here, and they may, on paper, give you a very high return for a very short period of time, followed by no return for a very long period of time, and it all equals out to something like 3% or 2%. And that's probably about as good as you're going to get. The reality is there's no such thing as a free lunch, which brings me to the next subject. The scam artists, for some reason or another, are still popping up. There is no shortage of people who are running something and they're getting caught, but there's probably a lot more who are running them and not getting caught. We've talked about the fact that there was a $245 million Ponzi scheme run here in Texas that just folded up, and it's likely we'll see more and more of those as time goes by. And if the market turns down and things get rough, you'll see them multiply. Anytime, let me give you an example of what's reasonable. And there's no, we're not guaranteed that our firm or anybody else can get this kind of return. But I tell you, a reasonable return in a well-balanced, diversified portfolio over time has consistently been about 4% above inflation. So if inflation's running along at about 2%, which it is right now, core inflation's running about 2%, over a long period of time, it's reasonable to look out there and see a 6% return. Now, let me tell you one of the troubles that you may run into with that. If you look, if you've been invested for at least 10 years and you've been in equities or a mixture, a balanced portfolio or something for the last 10 years, 10 years ago this week was the bottom of the bear market in 2009. You will probably have a nice double-digit return, compound return in your portfolio from the bottom of the market in 2009, 10 years out to today. Don't think that that's going to continue. It won't. Matter of fact, if you look at your five-year return, it'll probably be a very low number. That's also very reasonable because we were at a peak of a market 5 years ago before it dipped down into a, not a recession, but a, and it dipped into a correction. And so it was a little overpriced about 5 years ago. So you'll have a poor five-year number and a good 10-year number and probably a good 3-year number. Don't let those mislead you. Your long-term historic goal, and again, the future is still the future and thereby unclear and uncertain, is that you should be, for reasonable planning, you should expect to get about a 4% above inflation return. And this has worked through many, many years. And matter of fact, we can actually go back to 1900 and come forward in the markets with a balanced, well-balanced portfolio. Your average annual rate of return would have been about 4% above inflation. So these are things to bear in mind as we move into this, that you will encounter something or someone who promises you a much higher return and often say it's guaranteed. Don't just walk away from that, run away from that, because it's very unrealistic. If any company paid out 9.6% a year above what you invested for a long period of time, they would soon be out of business. They would soon be bankrupt, in which case you would be out of business too. Which brings me to another one. This is Jeff talking, by the way. We've seen some of these private, recently saw a private school, private college, university system that just folded up. And when it folded up, it wasn't very pleasant, it wasn't very pretty. It was downright ugly, and the ugliness about it was, maybe I can find the name of the company here that did it. The problem was that a lot of people had borrowed a lot of money, given a lot of money to a for-profit college chain. Here it is. Let's open it up. Dream Center, a Christian nonprofit bought a series of schools across the country, and like Argosy University, South University, and the Art Institutes. They had about 26,000 students in various programs. Most of the money that they had paid to the school was in student loans, and the schools are declaring bankruptcy and shutting down. First in line as creditors are going to be the people who they owe mortgages to and the people who they owe regular bills to, and the students are going to come in last. That doesn't mean the students don't owe the money on their student loans. It doesn't mean that they never got their degrees in many cases, and in many cases their credits are non-transferable. It's very, very important, if you know somebody who's trying to get an education, that they get it from an accredited institution that is solidly based financially. Now, admittedly, a lot of people are getting degrees from non-traditional institutions where they can get them part-time, and some of those degrees and some of those certificates are very, very valuable as they go to work, and they're actually learning something, and they have a useful skill when they come out and they can get a job. But at the same time, you're in an interesting position. If it's not state-backed, like the University of Texas system, Texas A&M system, those are backed by the state of Texas. They're not going to go out of business because the state of Texas is, in essence, places full faith and credit behind those universities. If you go into a private university or college system, or you know somebody who is doing that, it's very important, and the burden is on you or on the student, to go in and examine the financial stability of that organization. And if it's obscure and difficult to find, then avoid committing money to an organization that could plunge beneath the water tomorrow. And that's generally true across the board. If you can't see, if it's not transparent, and you're committing money to some corporation or organization, you are at great risk. And it may work out for some people, and other people are going to be left holding the bag. And that is one of the problems that we run into in a free and open society. We have a free market society. It's wide open. There's a lot of people doing a lot of things. You could say that, for instance, the Dream Center is a charity. It's wonderful. It's Christian. It's been around for 25 years. Well, the fact that their name was associated with Argosy University and some of the other schools, South University, doesn't mean that you didn't lose a lot of money when they went under, because you did. And it's one of those things just to be fully aware of as you go forward. Again, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. And this bad news is still pretty bad news, but it's out there. Let's see. We talked a little earlier about it, but it's worth repeating again. We had a blip in the economic news this week. The total non-farm payroll employment, I like the way the Department of Labor puts it, was little changed in February. We added 20,000 jobs. Now, bear in mind that historically, over the last 6 months, we've typically added 185,000 jobs per month. Adding 20,000 jobs is a major blip downward. And the question, of course, is this a harbinger of the peak in the economic cycle? Does it mean we can't find people to hire? Hiring is about to fall off, because that would indicate that things are headed downhill from here. And we certainly hope that's not true. But the reality is, we won't know until next month. Now, around April 7th, the Department of Labor will release another report. And if the second report that they release in April shows another $20,000 job gain or something in that vicinity, something less than $100,000, then we'll have something to worry about. But for the moment, just take this as a glitch. It could be a result of the data gathering hiccups because of the government shutdown. And it could indicate that we've reached a peak, but certainly not sliding downhill yet. But are we reached a peak? Because we did, as Jake said, we're still hiring. We hired 20,000 more people than we laid off. That is still right. Gain. Now, we need to hire 100,000 a month, roughly, to break even. But since we have 185,000 average over the last 6 months, we got plenty of room here to have some 20,000 a month go by without too much trouble.
Right.
It's one of those things that bears watching. We need to really keep our eyes on it. And one of the alarming things in there was that manufacturing actually had a decrease in jobs. Now, that fits with the trade deficit being out of whack. So these are something that don't get concerned about it yet. It'll be next month. If it continues next month, then we'll have something we can talk about. And if you want to worry about something, that'll give you something to worry about.
I always want something to worry about.
We need to have something.
How can we get through life without worrying about something?
That's true. Housing starts are still down a little bit. That's an indication that they're down a little bit. They're actually down a bunch on the moving average. The construction, well, an example. In February, construction, and it's a seasonally adjusted, declined by 31,000 jobs in February.
There's a interesting facet here when you talk about housing starts. This is, I watched that, and I was just showing you the graph before the program started. It's when you take out the seasonal adjusting nature of housing starts, it becomes predictive. It's amazing that people don't tend to start houses in December. People, say, how is this predictive? If you look back, go to fred.stlouisfed.org. Fred is their economic data distribution software.
Fred is a know-it-all.
Yeah, Fred knows everything. And you can look at these bulges in housing starts. Housing starts every year start low in January, get high around June or July, and then get low again in December.
That's the temperature.
Yeah, it's probably the temperature. Well, there's actually no doubt that it is the temperature. It's easier, number one, to build houses when there's not a lot of snow on the ground. Number two, people don't want to begin thinking about buying houses in the middle of Christmas. Google used to do an index of their search engine where they would show numbers of searches on a given day for a given set of search words. And they had a set of search words that were related to real estate stuff. And what's funny is that you could overlay their search engine index with the housing start index from the Federal Reserve. And you had this really kind of interesting thing. Every year you have this big bulge, and people have said it for years. People buy houses in the summer, and they try to sell houses in the winter, which is really kind of silly. You should be trying to sell your houses in the summer when people are trying to buy them. Housing starts, though, if you look at the low points and the high points, if the low points for the year are lower than the previous year, that's a sign that the economy is no longer expanding. And we've just hit that very clearly in the data. We've just hit that for January of this year. We are clearly below the low point. In fact, to go back to the last low point that was equivalent was at the end of 2014, the beginning of 2015.
When we had a near recession, we had a
right
and had a correction.
And that was still higher than the year before. So we have the same amount of housing construction going on, new housing development going on as we did, in essence, 4 years ago at this point. When we look back at other times in history when we're dropping our housing starts below what's been happening recently, it usually is a warning. Sometimes it's a multi-year ahead of time warning of a recession. For the Great Recession in 2006, our housing starts dropped. 2007, they did it again, and then 2008, we were in the recession.
I think what they should measure is housing stops.
Yeah, we should. I agree. I have never seen a house start anything except.
Well, they have housing starts, and then when they finish it, that should be a house stop.
Yeah, that should be another indicator somewhere.
And then measure the difference between the starts and the stops.
Yeah.
And see how many houses we lost along the way.
That would actually be a really good bit of information, but people don't tend to file paperwork when they stop construction on houses.
That'd make it more interesting to find.
Yeah, that would give somebody full-time jobs across the country. If we're ever out of jobs, we can do this. It would be relatively valueless, but it would be fun.
Overall, here's the picture. The economy is running at full tilt. We are at virtually full employment. We have used up a lot of the slack of people who were working part-time because of economic reasons. In other words, they couldn't find more jobs. There's fewer and fewer people who have multiple part-time jobs. We are basically at a point where it's about as good as it gets. We're also hitting capacity utilization constraints. We're running out of truck drivers. We're running out of trucks. We're running out of road capacity. We're running out of a lot of things that would indicate that we are peaking again. Can we stay at this peak, this plateau, for an extended period of time? Theoretically, if the Federal Reserve does everything just right and the federal government does everything just right and we drop the trade war, we could stay here quite a while. Historically, we've never been able to pull it off. Historically, a peak is followed a year or so later with a decline. And is that necessarily going to happen? I don't know. If I could tell you the future, you couldn't afford to listen to it.
Well, that's part of the problem with technical chart reporting. It's not really considered a peak unless it has a decline. It's just part of the incline upward.
But the good news is, and we're running out of time for this hour and for this week, but I just want to add one big thing. We do tend to look long-term. If you're a long-term investor, we can't predict when the next slump is going to occur. We can predict that, A, it's going to happen, and, B, we need them to happen. But coming out of that, if history is a guide, we're going to see an economic boom in the 2020s that will be something that will be probably bigger than any of us have seen who are alive today. As robotics increase and automation increases productivity and wealth gets spread around. Now, if you happen to be one of these people who basically is trying to do manual labor or something that is repetitious and you really rather not be doing it because it's boring, your job is at risk because a computer can do it, a robot can do it, an automated system can do it. But for the rest of us, the 2020s looks like the golden era of the 21st century, or maybe one of the golden eras of the 21st century, and I'm very optimistic about that. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and you can contact us off the air if you'd like, locally at 254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
Or you can reach that same voicemail during the weekend, real live people during the week, at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. We actually do give customized, personalized fiduciary investment advice to folks that need it. So we spend some time figuring out who you are before we start giving advice. You can also go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where we have newsletters going back. You can sign up for the newsletter on there. I think it's quite valuable. I really enjoy it, enjoy adding to it, and enjoy reading it. And you can also listen to recordings of this radio program going back through the years.
To 1846, isn't it?
Not quite to 1846. Okay. I'm not exactly sure.
It goes back to the last millennium.
It goes back quite a ways. I'm going to have to look at the dates on there to see exactly how far it goes. Multiple years, so you can see how right or wrong we have been in the past. And you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. We do read those emails and listen to people's comments and inspirations for the radio program. So until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach.